Happened with Reef Bum is sponsored by Polo Reef, Champion Lighting and Supply, and GHL.
Hey, what's happening, everybody? And welcome back to another episode of Rapping with Reef Bum. I'm your host, Keith Berkelhammer. So today on the live stream, I welcome back Tim Kelly, who owns Purple Monster Corals, which is a coral export business in the Solomon Islands. What's going on there, Tim?
Hey, happy, it's Wednesday here.
Yeah, what time of the day is it? It's the next day.
It's 10:03 in the morning on Wednesday.
All right, so it's at a reasonable hour for you. I've had some guests from Germany that have to be on at like a 1 o'clock their time to do the live stream, which I very much appreciate.
Yep.
So I appreciate you, man, taking the time again to be on the live stream to chat. You're doing it this time from your facility, which is going to be pretty cool because you're going to give us a little tour once we get into the media discussion of the facility and show us some of the corals that you have in that holding facility. But before we start chatting there, Tim, I want to take care of some business and thank the sponsors of this show. The sponsors are really important to me. They make the show possible with their support, and that means a lot since I want to continue to bring on awesome guests to help foster a learning environment on the show. Polo Reef is one sponsor. Make sure to check out Polo Reef's new YouTube video that drops this Friday. The Polo Reef team gives us a behind-the-scenes tour of Fitz Fish Ponds, that's a tongue twister, in New Jersey, where some of the most spectacular Japanese koi are imported. The journey includes the arrival of some of Polo Reef's prized fish, including Jennifer Aniston, who won grand champion in Polo Reef's video last week. Make sure to subscribe to their YouTube channel at Polo Reef for the video drop notifications. I had a picture of Jennifer Aniston last week. Tim, I don't have the picture again on this stream, but it was quite striking. I guess just similar to the actress.
A named koi fish.
I didn't know you named koi fish, but makes sense to me.
It's a great story.
Yeah. Champion Lighting and Supply, appreciate their support. Besides being a place for hobbyists to purchase saltwater aquarium supplies online, Champion Lighting is also a wholesale distributor for many popular brands. If you own an aquarium store or an aquarium service company, contact Champion Lighting through their website at championlighting.com to set up a wholesale account. My third sponsor is GHL. Personally, I'm all in on using GHL products. I have a lot of success using their dosers, their Profilux controllers, the Mitra's lights, the Cage Director, etc. They produce high-quality German-engineered products. All right, man. With all that out of the way, let's talk reef, man. Tim, the last time I had you on in November, we had a great talk, but can you refresh people's memory in case they don't recall that conversation in terms of what Purple Monster Corals is all about?
Sure. So we are a small sort of artisanal coral export business. We do quite a bit of coral farming, propagating with local villages. The whole point is to sort of develop the Solomons as an exporting country for aquarium fish and corals. We don't do fish yet. But, it's on the radar. But to, hire locals and to use local materials and to develop Solomon aquatic exports. It's got a long history. There's been something like 1991, 1992, I think was the original exports coming out of the Solomons. And so we're sort of pulling on that legacy to grow here.
Go ahead.
No.
I was just going to ask you in terms of what kind of how's the volume been over the last since you started exporting corals? I mean, has the volume of exports for you increased, remained about the same? What do you think the future holds in terms of that stuff?
It's remained about the same. We've got a whole lot of potential built up, sort of potential energy on farming that hasn't been tapped yet. We had Jake come out in 2019. In March of 2019, he came out and we sort of kickstarted coral farming. And that was right in time to get them ready to export as COVID developed the year later.
Yeah.
So that put a wet blanket over the whole thing. So you know, rebuilding that, and then looking at other locations, looking in, you know, just locations outside of this island. But yeah, so as far as coral farming goes, the potential is sort of staggering. But with the coral exports as it is, we're about the same as we were last year. You know, 20 to 25 box shipments, things like that every week to 2 weeks. It's not massive. It's, you know, artisanal scale. It's not industrial.
Is that just because of the challenges you face in terms of being able to collect at a larger scale, or is it government restrictions, or is it just demand on the,
volume wise, it's not a government restriction. There are some, you know, being a developing country, there's a lot of potholes in the road, is maybe the best way to put it. There's a lot of failure points in the chain of custody. I mean, to get an export out, I have to have, you know, it's a fisheries license. And then after a fisheries license, that took me a year and a half to get in the first place. After fisheries license, it's CITES permit for the export. One missed email can push that back a week or two because you have windows to export. And then after you've landed that, then it's the airlines. Anyone there cannot answer an email or a phone call, and that kicks it another week. Once the airlines is lined up, then the airlines has to communicate because we're transiting through Fiji. If Fiji is difficult, that can create, you know, so there's so many failure points that we take for granted in more developed countries, you know, say Australia or even Indonesia. Indonesia is like sixth most developed country in the world. Or sixth highest GDP, something like that. Anyways, they're pretty darn developed. So compared to those countries, it's tough. You know, it's there's a lot of places where people can drop the ball, and there's not a whole lot of consequences for dropping the ball. There's for me. I mean, that's a missed whole week of business lost, right? But for the people that I need to interface with, there's failure points for sure.
Right. I remember your last conversation, you were talking about how the internet was, you know, not the most reliable type of service out there. I can even imagine like sending emails to these people that you're waiting responses on, and like that stuff falling potentially in spam folders. I'm assuming there's spam folders out there that,
It's, you have to follow up. People don't, I mean, again, like I grew up with the internet, right? Like, you know, I'm born in 84, but like I grew up with the internet by like what, sixth grade, we were learning to make websites in public school, right? Like here, a lot of people, like they don't have an email account that's stable. And so like just managing like, oh, new contact, put it in the folder, send a handshake email to make sure it doesn't get sent to the spam folder. Those aren't customs that people have here. So things get lost. Also, you know, interfacing with a village, I mean, just trying to keep a cell phone charged when you're out of town. Like once you leave town boundaries, you're 50 years in the past. So power is screwed.
You know,
they've got maybe 150 solar watt panel for the whole village. Oh. And that'll charge up a little like motorcycle battery. And then from that motorcycle battery, they'll charge their cell phones. But you know, if it's a cloudy day, or if someone forgot to connect it, or if someone got a little greedy and took too much power, the person you're trying to reach might just not be able to charge their cell phone for a day or two or three. It's just how it is. So, and cell phone towers go down. Yeah, it's goofy. Things happen.
Let's see here. See some familiar faces in the chat here. Well, great Beard of Reef, the moderator. What's happening there? Paul, Brandon, Scott, Art. What's happening? Alex Correa from Hawaii. ACI. Chris Meckley's in the house there. What's going on there, Chris? A couple of other comments. But so, all right. What about the no additional red tape issues in terms of dealing with the government for exporting purposes? That's kind of pretty much you got the same sort of thing, hurdles that you got to deal with on the government side of things over there.
Yeah, I mean, there's always some, and we're dealing with a you know, all coral is an endangered species, so it, you know, you have to deal with CITES paperwork, and that creates its own, you know, overlay of complications. But we navigate it. We're pretty comfortable navigating it now. There was definitely some hair pulling moments at first, but we're 5 years in. So yeah, we've got that aspect figured out. So it's an election year. So it's always fun here for elections. So
anybody you're lobbying for to win the election?
No, I stay out of politics as best as I can.
All right. A couple of questions here. So Chris is wondering, are you seeing any bleaching on Solomon reefs, any bleaching events?
I, for the first time, am seeing bleaching on a reef that I like to collect on, and I'm seeing crown of thorns stars on that same reef.
That
sucks. It's getting hit hard. Yeah. So yeah, this is coastal Guadalcanal. I'm seeing bleaching and crown of thorns.
What I mean, so are crown of thorns kind of opportunistic in that sense? When corals are in distress, they'll try to somehow gravitate
My
there.
My understanding is it's more like a locust thing. So they'll have a boom of population where they'll just go crazy, and it'll be like every 3 feet there's a crown of thorns star, and they're everywhere. And I'm seeing them small right now. You know, they get massive. But so they boom, and then I think that they wipe out some reefs, and then they starve to death, and then they have a bunch of babies, and a couple years later that pop. So I think it's like a, kind of like a sine wave of population, just like with locusts. So they go crazy, they eat up crops, and then they disappear for a couple years, and then they come back real bad. There's been a lot of thought that like it's from shell collection, the big Triton shells, mm-hmm. Those Triton conchs or Triton whelks, that they eat them. I don't see a whole lot of that collection going on here. Like tourism curio stuff, but I think it's just a natural phenomenon that every couple of years you get these booms in crown of thorns stars. But they're nasty. I mean, I don't know if you've ever gotten stabbed by one, but I try to whenever I see them, perforate them, drop a rock on them. But they the spikes that are all over them, they create this really bad throbbing pain if you get jabbed by them. So
is that a thing? Like I know in the Keys, I think it is off of Florida. You can hunt lionfish, right? Is that a thing in terms of crown of thorns there?
There are reef restoration operations. Or like I was talking with the operator for Billy Kiki, a pretty famous dive operation here. They will, when they don't have booked up schedules, like if they've got a couple days free, they'll go around with syringes and they inject them with like, I think it's basically calflosser. They inject them with that and that kills them. I unfortunately just don't have the time or means to be doing it, but I'd like to have that point where like, 2 days a month or 3 days a month, we just go out and zap crown of thorns. That's, that's a doable thing.
Yeah. But man, that's gotta be a daunting task though. I mean, that's the wild and they're, and part of the food chain, so to speak there. Right. And it's kind of, it's a pest. And, pests are part of reefs in the wild and part of reefs in at home. So,
yeah. Yeah. And major studies have been like throughout Australia, they do a lot of, studies in Great Barrier Reef in these populations. And it seems like not a whole lot of like positive, like they don't know exactly what the cause is. They don't know exactly the best way to get rid of them or to manage them, or if management is really what's needed. If it just sort of plays the cycle out, and then 10 years later or 8 years later, whatever their cycle is, they come back again. But the reefs, reefs have been around for at least, corals as we know them, reefs of something like 70 or 80 million years. But reefs have been around for hundreds of millions of years. So they'll survive this. This too will pass.
I see there's some conversation in the chat about Asternia snails, starfish. I mean, the little guys, is that a pest out in the Solomons?
I don't see them. And definitely like when I was taking care of reef tanks in Los Angeles, once one got in a tank, it was a thing, yeah. Right? It was more a thing on our acrylic tanks, because if you're using a magnet, they can get under the magnet and scratch up the acrylic.
Yeah.
I don't see them here, and it's I'm not looking, but I don't see them here. Really on corals here, we'll get blue-eyed crabs, the really annoying crabs you get from farms. So we get blue-eyed crabs, and then we get the little coral croucher gobies, black clown gobies, basically. We'll get those in corals. And then there's a couple little shrimps that we'll get that seem to be commensal, but I don't see Asterina stars. At least I haven't seen them. And after we clear the raceways of coral for an export, I don't see them lingering in the tanks.
Yeah. I always think that Harlequin shrimp are the best defense against those starfish. It's kind of a sad thing because they'll you put one of those things in a home reef aquarium, they'll wipe out the Asterina starfish, but then they'll starve. You got to get them out and give them to another reefing brother or sister to kind of help them out and pass them.
Yeah, if you can catch them.
Yeah. So, all right, this. Another question I had for you in terms of any new locations that you're collecting in, what does that take, man? I mean, like you said, there's got to be so much territory to cover. How do you kind of map out a plan to kind of tap into a new frontier Is it just a matter of doing some scouting on your part to see what areas look like, kind of prime locations?
It's sort of all of the above. I mean, it's looking at maps and charts and I don't want to give away too much. Yeah, like there is competition. Yeah, but it's really the biggest thing here is once you have an export license. So unlike Indonesia, where like if you have an export license, you're stuck to your state or your island essentially of where you're allowed to collect in. And you can't collect coral from another region and bring it over for export. That region has to export its own coral. Here in Solomons, I can export from anywhere in the Solomons. So if I fly to the other side of the country and collect coral, I can take that to farms and grow it. But what it doesn't grant is the privilege to go to someone's reef. There's a whole lot of village sovereignty here. Like every man is his own duke or earl. Every village is its own sovereign territory. So if I want to collect, like I have to go to that village ahead of time, describe what I want to do, make my pitch. A lot of times it's going weeks ahead of time, bring in some betel nuts, bring in some cigarettes. I don't smoke or chew betel nut, but sitting under a tree and having a conversation. And if you don't do that and you take liberties with like, oh, well, I collected from the neighbor, I come over here and collect, your boat will get boarded with machetes and angry people. They're not swinging them, but they're there to make a point, so you don't do that. There's, a lot of the really good reefs have been set aside as marine protected zones, which is a good thing. Where when I had Jake out in 2019, he went out to Simon's Reef, which is like now an established marine protected zone. Like you don't collect off that. You'll do jail time if you collect off that. So
I was going to ask you, have you been back to Simon's coral preserve, but I guess not.
No, I have. Okay. We're actually going close there in the next like 4 or 5 days. Yeah. It's still looking good. I mean, he was for years a marine collector. So he, he has an eye for coral and it's his reef. So whenever he saw cool stuff, he was like, oh, I'll take a piece, collecting wildflowers. I'll take some seeds from that. I'll take some seeds from that. Yeah. He made his own little garden under the
right,
water.
Exactly. Pretty much what he was doing was taking stuff, I guess, out in the reefs around in the surrounding area and kind of planting them in a little, what would you call a farm close to the island?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, he's blessed with a really cool location where, 1 kilometer to the left, he's got open ocean of sort of one type of topography, like open ocean. 1 kilometer or half a kilometer to the right, not east, it's more south, but 1 kilometer the opposite direction, he's got more protected open ocean, like less wind battered open ocean, but clean water. In that channel, he's got different topography of like low energy, high energy. He's got it all. So he really is in like a prime location to build a garden of different types of coral, like a botanical garden, really, of coral.
That's so cool. What about the coral triangle, Tim? Describe to people what that is again.
Sure. So coral triangle is a collection of countries. It's an area defined by the density of species. So it means that you've got, I believe it's 500 species of coral. So the region of the sea is all of the Philippines. I guess I'm inverted from you, but all of the Philippines, the very eastern end of Malaysia or western end of Indonesia, the north side of Papua New Guinea, and the right side of that triangle would be Solomon Islands. So Solomon Islands is just included in that group of 500 species. So, yeah.
I mean, and
yeah, it's a very abstract triangle, but yeah.
And it sounds pretty pretty large area in terms of collecting and
with maps. Entirety of the Philippines, the majority of Indonesia, the entire north half of Papua New Guinea, and Papua New Guinea is almost a microcontinent. It's massive. And all of the Solomon Islands. I mean, Solomon Islands alone, it's 1,000 islands, 990 islands, and 400 miles long. I mean, it's huge. So, and that's only one leg of the coral triangle. So the coral triangle as a whole is, hundreds of thousands of miles of ocean.
How do you think the Solomon Islands is going to be, will things change with the upcoming ban on Indo exporting, being able to export Indo corals? Will that change the dynamic, do you think?
I don't know. I mean, we started this business 5 years ago when Indo was still locked up and the demand was pretty big. With Indo closing down, I mean, that really just drove up demand for Indo corals. That was when torch corals went to astronomical prices, Indonesian torch corals. I don't know. I can't predict the future. I've tried to predict the future and it's never exactly gone the way I thought it would go. So I think I'm out of the prognostication business. It's definitely a hope. I mean, it's what's bad for Indonesian coral exporters might be good for me. I don't want to, you know, dance at their misfortune, but if demand goes up, that's a good thing. Yeah. Right. There's other exporters, you know, there's Tonga can fill up some of that, on, you know, the lower end side. They've tried farm corals out of Marshall Islands at one point. Yep. Other countries can export corals with, if the conditions are right. But, yeah, I mean, I'm poised and ready. If global demand goes up, it's hard, competing. I mean, I'm operating out of my pocketbook, right? Like I don't have deep pockets to you know, deep amounts of capital to draw on to scale up. So a lot of this has been, you know, there's been some missed opportunities because I'm just not ready to capitalize on them. But, should Indo close down, I mean, no longer am I compared to the, I don't even know how many operators there are in Indonesia, but they're working with, you know, land prices that are a tenth of what they are here in Solomons and labor costs that are a quarter of what they are here. It's not a cheap country to operate in. You know, house rentals are almost the price of, like, it's not as expensive as Los Angeles where I'm from, but it's like Florida pricing to rent a house here, you know, 2000 US a month to rent an average, you know, not fancy house. It's not cheap. So whereas Indonesia, I mean, I'd be spending a quarter of that, $500 or less for a, you know, a two-story house, with a pool and suite aircon. Like I don't have that here. You know, I couldn't afford that if I wanted to. So it's a tougher business climate to operate in Solomons. And you know, your average consumer in the United States doesn't care. They just want their coral at a cheap price. Right. So it rubbed me a little bit and I've had to get over it because, you know, you got to go with what the market demands. I definitely learned that. But, you know, when I present a coral and they're like, oh, that looks like Tonga, I'll pay Tonga prices. Or, oh, that looks like Indo, I'll pay Indo prices. Like, but it's so much harder to get. And it's genetically different. And, you know, kind of my whole spiel with how the reptile market cares about stuff like that. Like, oh, this is from this weird, obscure island that people only go to once a year, once every 5 years. The coral buying market or the Instagram fad market, whatever, they don't care. And if I do, that doesn't help me sell corals. So, I guess that's my long way of answering. If Indo shuts down, I guess it would probably be easier to sell coral.
Yeah. What are the like basic differences in terms of the types of corals that you could export from the Solomons versus the types of corals that you could export from Indo? I mean, are there like any obvious differences or is it not?
I think, and I could be wrong. I could totally be wrong here, but I believe that like Europe has a ban on Euphelia from Indonesia. I think that it was decided on their end, on the receiving side, that it was not being collected at a sustainable or ethical way. And so they put the kibosh on it. I think they can buy from Australia, and because I don't think that falls under that ban. And I would assume that means that they're allowed to buy from us, or they're allowed to import from us. So that might be one, but that's the only one that I know of off top of my head. I mean, I really have had to sort of bury my head in what's going on here. When I was working in Los Angeles and importing, I was so much more up to date with, you know, current trends, current buying trends. And also, you know, in a previous iteration of this company, I was going back home every couple months. And so I could sort of get the pulse on things a lot better. Now I'm here full time. And it's been a good thing for the business here, but it's been a bad thing as far as my, you know, just awareness of what's going on in Australia and what's going on in Indonesia. And what are people in Hong Kong buying? You know, it has changed. My awareness has definitely changed. I'm a lot more dependent upon my customers, which is a little bit scary. So, you know,
here's an honest question from Messiah Mitra. Why did Tim choose to farm in Solomon Islands despite the high prices and difficulties? Why Solomon?
Sure. I was first here in 2008 as a consultant for Dave Palmer's company, Aquarium Arts, Pacific Aquafarms. I was working for him in Los Angeles and he sent me out here as a consultant and I fell in love with the place. When I decided to start this business, so based on those connections and those friends and that just, you know, time here, I spent months here. So based on that, in 2008, I was in Australia on a buying trip when Australia was the only exporting company or country of note. And essentially, the guys that I went there with, Jake had invited me out. I'll tell the Jake story another time, but I had to find a place to stay last minute. Okay, so when he was setting up the Australian Reef Stock Australia, he's like, hey, Tim, like, I'd love for you to come out. You know, I want you to work the door or something, but like, come on out and I will take care of your room and board. Just you take care of your airplane tickets. It's like, I fly out there and volunteer work for free. Like, thanks, dude. Yeah. but okay. All right. I got room and board at least, you know? And so I had enough money saved up to do that. And so I told a coworker and he's like, well, I want to go too. Okay. We'll both go, you know? And then he was like, well, we got to tell our boss. I'm like, don't tell our boss. I got to tell our boss. You know, I would just say, I want a week off, you know? But he's like, okay. So he told the boss and boss is like, well, I want to go too. And so now it's a company trip. So that meant that airfare was covered. That was kind of nice. That was expensive airfare. And then, you know, he invited his wife and it became like a kind of a party, you know? And so he got out there, we were the only Americans there.
Wow.
So like we were the brightest bell at the ball, yeah. You know, like everyone was like, oh, yeah. Come out to Arctic Station and come out to Western Australia, come up to Brisbane, come over to Darwin. And so between the four of us, we kind of had our dance cards filled as far as like, okay, you're going to go to Brisbane, you're going to go to Perth, you're going to go to Darwin, you're going to go to Cairns. Like we, you know, going to all these facilities. And then it was like, well, Tim, where are you going to go? Like, what are you going to do? And like, well, Solomon's is next door. You know, Solomon's, it's $600 US to fly there. Let's see what's going on. Because I'd heard that the station had gone bankrupt. And so came up here and hooked up with, you know, some of my old friends from here. And you're not working. Do you want to work? Yeah. So I put together a business plan and it made sense. So it was sort of the business was in hibernation, you know? So it wasn't like starting from the ground up. It really was shaking off the dust and, you know, sort of finding what was efficient, what wasn't efficient and, you know, recalibrating it to suit my needs. So, yeah.
All right. Getting back to politics, Sturgis Reef is wondering, what is the local regulation like there? And do you see much pollution that affects the reefs?
In town, there's a lot of pollution. I mean, no one thinks twice about throwing their trash in a local stream or river. It's gross. On a pedestrian level, the pollution is really bad, and all that goes right down the sea. So every time it rains, streams are flooded because the drains and the underpasses are clogged up, and so that creates a lot of erosion. So anytime it rains, noteworthy wise, there is mud. The whole coastline is covered in mud. After about 3 days, that goes down. It's gross. It's not a fight I can fight now. The Ministry of the Environment, who issues CITES permits, actually just instituted a plastic bag ban, which means that the shopping t-shirt plastic bags, you know, like the, you know, two-handle red thin plastic bags, those are now outlawed. And and small single-use plastic bottles are outlawed as well. So that might make a difference. I'm still seeing the big liter and a half bottles getting thrown in the streams and stuff. Fishing line isn't being regulated, and a lot of the reefs I dive on, I actually have to have a knife to like make sure I don't get snagged with fishing lines, just remnant ghost fishing lines. So on a pedestrian level, pollution's pretty bad here. I've been on reefs, though, like one of my favorite reefs to collect on, just outside of town, there was a logging dam put out because there's logging is the main industry, and of course that puts a lot of mud in the water. That logging dam, it's also next to a stream. And so the logging dam creates erosion and kind of disrupts the coastline. So after rains, you'll have mud in the water. And from that stream, you'll have like a freshwater lens running on the top of the water for a bit until it mixes. And like, I've been collecting Acropora robusta growing straight up through that freshwater lens and into the muddy, nasty freshwater. And that robusta has perfect, you know, the green with the pink tips, it's happy. It's showing all signs that it's getting exactly what it wants, despite freshwater runoff, land-based, you know, terogenous pollution. There was a ship, because it's a logging area, there was a ship maybe half kilometer, 300 meters, 400 meters upstream of where I was. And they're hosing off their deck and there's oil slick coming off of that because they don't care. And those corals look fine. So I think that there's a lot of resiliency in corals that are used to not perfect conditions. In the harbor, I've seen, I think it was Postulopora, growing on a rock right where all these big industrial boats are anchoring and setting up. So like, what's that line from Jurassic Park, Nature Finds a Way?
Yeah.
You know, like it's coral's tough here. I think that first question we got about bleaching, I am seeing bleaching. So, you know, it's taking hits, but I think it stands back up, you know?
Yeah. Sturgis Reef says, yeah, high nutrients, I guess, laugh out loud. That's interesting because, you know, I would assume that the corals that are thriving near the you know, the areas where you're seeing all this influx from, you know, runoff and what have you, can tolerate much higher nutrients and stuff that versus stuff that's further out, right?
Right, correct. So on this reef, which is sort of bounded, like this bay bounds Honiara, and you've got 70,000 people, you know, putting their waste. It's all septic, which means that there is leaching. There's nutrients. Let's just say nutrients running into the sea. It's on the leeward side that I'm seeing millepores, which are a hungry, you know, high energy, high light, high nutrient demanding coral. So that very well could be part of the reason that they're so happy here. And I see more of them here than I do on other reefs that have similar facings, you know, similar coastline facing, similar wind and swell direction. But here they're denser, and it very likely is nutrient available.
How do you manage that in your holding facility? You know, if you've got corals that are being collected from different areas with different parameters, you know, maybe some that are getting collected from waters with high nutrients versus low nutrients. How do you manage that in terms of keeping those corals happy before you export them?
A lot of that is, you know, placement in the facility, knowing which tanks are warmer, knowing which tanks are cooler, how long we run our pumps for, how much water flow oxygenation we give them. You know, deep water corals that I'm collecting at 70, 80, sometimes even 90 feet, they don't want the conditions that millepore wants. They'll stress out and die quickly. So yeah, keeping those away from, I mean, you can kind of see the...
Yeah, man, why don't you give us a little dime tour of the facility? Yeah, let's do that. Why not?
And I'll change the camera facing.
Yeah. Flip your camera around. Give everybody a look-see in terms of what you got going on there.
So we're at three holding tanks right now, which we built by hand here. Actually, I need to paint this guy. So let me turn off our pumps and
just remember to turn them back on after you show
right.
us.
Oh yeah. I'm the guy who yells at people for not turning back on. So like right now I've got our deep waters facing sunlight just because we collected them early and I want them to keep color.
Those are all deep water acros.
These are all deep water acropora. So with these guys, let's settle a little bit with these guys. They're going to be in captivity a bit long. And so I want to keep their sugar content. I want them to photosynthesize. So we've got some Recordias that are worth showing. Let's see. It's nice. These are Recordias that we collect at shallow water. I'll get a,
cool. Nice.
Yeah. I'll get their orange mouth, purple, you know, purple. They're nice. Some Rhodactis mushrooms. Here, these are, it's not showing in sunlight. I'll get a blue light. Unfortunately, it's going to be swamped out by all the sunlight, but yeah. These do fluoresce red. They're real pretty. We've got some farmed leather corals in stock, the yellow leathers that everyone knows from Fiji.
Yep.
We also have a pretty nice yellow leather here.
Nice.
Yeah.
Sweet.
So yellow leather, and then we have what we call devil's hand leather, but Cinellaria.
Yep.
A green Cinellaria, and these are all, you know, we make the discs here, we show the villagers how to make them, and they go from there. But yeah, I think most of the people online are probably into Acropora, so let me get my blue light out and see if that'll
light them up,
show these off a little better. Yeah, give me a minute. It's the first time I've done this, so I'm about as tech savvy as most people's grandpa.
Putting on the orange yellow lens there.
Exactly. All right. So again, it's going to get drowned out. Here's actually, that's a blue millepora that's going out to farm right now. So we're actually going to go drop this off. But
when you say going out to farm, what do you mean?
So if I see a coral that catches my eye and it's like this one, we were able to, you know, chew pieces off of it that were trimble in size for export, but this piece is just not really exportable. It's not photogenic, but the, you know, genetics are good on it. So that's going to go to a farm for propagation.
There's some farm, meaning a farm out in the wild.
In the provinces, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, here's some stilago. And fortunately, so this thing looks amazing at night, but blown out with, it's got like pink tips and green, but it's just not going to show very well during daylight, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But Lacanis, more stilago. We've got some Plana over here.
Love that's the Plana.
Yeah, it's a great coral. So we clicked that piece, got some over here.
The Crayola Plana is like one of my favorites.
Oh, yeah, a great coral.
Yeah, yeah.
A great
coral. They're a little sensitive, though, too, you know? I find them
they
to
are,
be
yeah, like
sensitive.
like all of our deep water acroporas, they are. Let me turn this light off. Light, turn off. All right, there we go. Light's off. I'm gonna kill the orange filter. I think it's just not really, unfortunately, not working. But yeah, we've got about, what,
180 pieces of deep water aquaphor in right now. Good mix of Locanis and Planas and Aculeus. That looks like, actually looks like Caroloniana with really long polyps. Here's another piece. I don't know if you can see this guy, but.
Nice.
Is that?
Yeah.
I mean, out of the, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, like I mean, like you're saying, it's kind of like all blown out in terms of, you know, you can't see any of the colors because you don't have any the lighting on top of it. But
right, white. I've got white sunlight on it.
Yeah.
But when these go to the United States, within about they'll probably have to rest for a few weeks. But that's when we start to see oranges and colors really come out of them. Here, Lobophilias, Lobos symphalia. I think that's been unionized, right? Lobophilia and symphalia has been sort of a they've rejoined the groups.
Oh yeah.
Here is a nice gold torch, kind of a pink peachy gold torch. Yeah. So that was collected. This is actually collected in the same area that I collect, shallow water, like, Milliporus. But, I went a little bit deeper, went to see what else I could find there. And then some chalice corals and like Monopora sebuensis. This is that one that it's got blue polyps and it'll turn really orange under captive condition, like a beach bum.
What's up? Oh, that's a cool Monty.
Beach bum.
Yeah. Bahama Llama Coral. What's happening, Remy? So anything new, any new discoveries, anything really cool that Tim, that you've collected recently that you haven't seen before?
That I can disclose?
They're not being sequestered in a secret part of the facility there.
Yeah, not today. We did see, I mean, these are kind of cool. So these, I don't think they're going to go for export. But one of my station managers was out. It was Easter weekend and he was out, just sort of diving and poking around and he pulled up these yellow seahorses.
Oh.
My facility. And I don't know the species. I'm not a seahorse expert by any means.
Yeah.
But this fella was actually, you can see his belly's swollen. He let go of the babies. So they're clustered up over here. They're going to go back out in the sea, but,
the babies.
Yeah, we wanted to identify the species at least. Yeah. Again, I'm sorry, it's not photographing very well, but there's probably about 150 little seahorses poking around this coral holding facility. We turned off the drains out to the ocean, but, yeah, we got four of them. So, and they're all yellow. I don't know the species. And they're not going to go for export because I believe all, I'm going to turn the camera back around. I believe all seahorses are CITES protected in the same way that like cleansing corals and all that are. So, but
you know what? Show us like the actual, shoreline. I mean, your facility is right there.
Yeah, sure.
You know, let's just check that out while you're, finish off the tour there in terms of exactly where you are. In the Solomons.
Yeah, so.
There you go. There's the ocean.
Yeah, we're right. I mean, the facility had to be with, you know, access to fresh seawater.
Because that's what you're bringing into your holding tanks.
Right. We wanted to be able to bring in fresh seawater and then launch a boat, but twice we've built boat ramps, and you can see these boat ramps get destroyed.
Twice.
The cyclones are sort of lensed right here on the facility. And so we'll get waves splashing higher than that light post.
So damn, man, that's gotta be a drag in terms of your holding tanks.
It's a struggle. So between December and February, it's tough. It's tough to, you know, predict when we'll be able to operate out of here. Another thing, again, I don't know if it's going to show in the, I'm just going to show in the video, but you can see this dock is made out of a bunch of World War II artillery shells that make up the volume of this dock. This was a dump site, so buried in in concrete. Let me turn around, like this one. I don't know if you can see that.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, there's hundreds and hundreds of these things.
There's got to be some heavy metals in the water around those things.
Yeah. Well, yeah, steel. I worked with Triton for a long time, and we had sort of a funny experience where a guy dropped a hammer in his tank, and then we ran the Triton analysis on it, and it was actually wasn't creating a problem, but that was one hammer in a tank, not tons of steel on a dock.
Yeah.
Right.
A little different.
It's worth actually running a
an analysis on it, right? Like Triton is, they have a lab in Cairns that's only maybe 200 miles away from here, 250 miles away from here. So I'm sure I can get them a sample.
Speaking of Triton, you were on that expedition years ago, right? In terms of the search with Jake, in search of the True Purple Monster. We talked about that, I think, the last time I had you on. And I remember you saying that there was likely going to be some of that purple monster being exported to the States. What's going on with that, man? Is there any news on that?
We sent 10 pieces so far have gone into the States. We're set up to collect more this weekend. Nice. It's now being farmed in a pretty good quantity. So, yeah, wow. That's something you expect to see on the market.
That's going to be so cool. And does it look like the traditional Tyree Purple Monster that all the hobbyists know in terms of kind of like the dense, thicker branches? Or because I think there was also some different kind of, shapes to that coral that you guys had seen on that follow-up expedition.
The initial set that we sent out was farmed in a really goofy way. It was farmed in a way that's really good for reef restoration, but not for coral sales. So they put it on strings, and on those strings, it was sort of falling as it was growing. And so it was fighting, it was growing in a really weird way to right itself. Again, it grows a lot of volume of coral quickly, and it's good for reef restoration when your only goal is to put coral on a reef. But when you're trying to sell to an American market, they want it to have a concrete disc grown more like a Christmas tree, grown vertically.
Right.
So we've made that correction. We'll see. That's what's going to be coming in. But when we collected, there was, some internet experts were saying that, that's the Solomon Island purple monster. It's not the OG purple monster. And it's not. I mean, like, I do believe in strains, right? So if you have this strain of purple monsters collected in 1995 through Tyree, that's a one of, that's what that is, right? That's purple monster from that. We went to the exact same reef, collected from the exact same reef that coral was collected from. So genetically, it's probably 99.99 and a lot of numbers after that percent the same coral, right? But is it that exact strain with that exact same, history of facing and sea swell? No, it's not. And corals do, they'll release symbionts and retake up new symbionts as ocean conditions change. So it could have a different set of zooxanthellae in it and respond differently to different stimulus. But was it the same species, the same strain of the same species collected on the same reef? Yeah, it was the exact same reef. But, they're saying polyp color was slightly different, and it's entirely possible. Again, different growing conditions. We're not growing under the exact same lights or bulbs or water chemistry or salt mixes that we were in 1995. So things change. But, I think we got as close as you can to a bullseye on collecting that species, that coral from that location. But I wish that there was a better registry of I've worked for coral, mail order coral exporters, coral shippers throughout the United States. I've worked for importing companies. I've seen kind of every level of coral custody coming into the United States and getting sold. And a wild coral comes in from Indonesia, 15 different retailers can buy it, and they all call it 15 different things, even though it's coming in from the same farmer, from the same, batch, from the same mother colony in Indonesia. It's annoying because I don't think it helps anybody. But I understand the reason that these retailers are doing it. I just wish there was maybe a better naming system, more scientific, or, you look at Meckley's in the room, he's a major farm producing line strains and really trying to keep that history. And that's commendable. It's tough to do. I understand how tough that fight is. So I don't know. Once I sell a coral, it's out of my hands. I can't control who calls something what and what they want to sell it for.
Yeah, kind of
one coral. What's that?
I was going to say, it's got to be kind of almost like a helpless feeling a little bit. You're passing it off it's just kind of, it's out of your hands.
You want to protect your brand. Yeah. You want to protect your brand that you built. I mean, I put my life, taking a lot of risks on my life and my credit, and my romantic life and all that being out here, and then you sell the product to somebody, they can do whatever they want with it. It's scary. But that's what I signed up for. Right. Famously, I had a coral that we collected. I think I saw $40 for it, maybe landed, and it sold for like $6,500 wholesale.
$6,500
for a colony.
Whoa.
Yeah. For a graph for a colony. Yeah,
this is a
that was rad. I really wish that the vendor put Solomon Islands on it, at least said where it came from. But the vendors, they want to keep that stuff secret for their own reasons. So it's, you know, no one's on a contract. It's not, you know, we're not Monsanto selling seeds where there's patents on the seed genetics and, you know, people have to pay you royalties. It's out of my hands at that point. So,
do you adjust pricing based on those sorts of episodes where, you know, all of a sudden you get wind of what it retails for and then you're like, shit, man, I got to make some money on this.
If I know that everyone needs to make money, right? And I want my customers to be excited to open a box and like, there might be the next $1,000 coral in there, right? Like I want them to feel comfortable knowing that if I send them a box of coral, they're going to make money, right? It would be greedy to be like, well, I have to make my, you know, 50% or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, every exporter has their own way of doing it. Some of the Australian guys have seen, like, if they see something truly unusual, they'll put an auction on that one coral. And then whoever wins the auction, like, it'll get added into their whole order. It's not just a one-off. That's a lot of organization. And I really want to be focusing on being in the water. But I've seen that idea floated. Generally speaking, I mean, I want my customers to have faith because I know where I am in the food chain, right? Like I'm not a retailer. I'm not an importer, right? Like they've got their own risks and liabilities with those companies and higher labor costs and higher fixed costs of, you know, and all those things. So I get them coral, they then sell it and they're entitled to make as much money as they can as long as their customers are happy themselves.
Fair enough. Yeah. Bahama Llama, yeah. Coral Remy, thank you very much, man, for that super chat. Comment is tradition. Yes. The super chat tradition. Appreciate it, dude. Back to the Purple Monster, the stuff that you've been collecting and exporting, the signature white polyps.
You know what? I don't want to commit to that. I'll bring some pieces in this week and I'll be able to look at them a lot closer. I'm happy to send you some photos, but in the wild, I didn't see it, but in the wild, I don't have the conditions to like get polyps out, sit there and photograph it with the macro.
Yeah.
I'm pretty limited on technology here. So likely, yes, but I don't want to make a promise that I can't deliver on. I hope that that's fair.
Yeah, no, I hear you, man. I mean, I've got Purple Monster and mm-hmm. I've had it in different tanks over the years, you don't always see the white polyps. They're not always visible. I think it just kind of depends on the conditions of the parameters of the tank and the lighting and all that sort of thing. It's not always like, you know, people are like, unless it's got the white polyps, it's not an OG Tyree Purple Monster, right. But I don't think that's always the case. I mean, I don't think I've always noticed that up in my Purple Monster frags colonies.
That was Jake's observation, and I mean, he was here with me collecting it. That's a perfectly fair observation. I remember in 2005, like cutting up colonies of Purple Monster when I was working with Vivid. I didn't notice the white polyps on it then. But you know, again, that if Tyree Purple Monster is the one from 1995, that's valid. That's 100% valid. The one that we collected in 2015 was from that expedition, and we only had maybe three or four small pieces made it to the United States from that trip. We didn't collect everything we saw. We wanted to leave it behind. Jake didn't disclose this, but when he came back in 2019, I was focused on getting my license sorted out, so I couldn't go with him back out to that reef. But it got wiped out by a cyclone. We've since found it again on that reef, but the patch that we had collected and documented in 2015 was wiped out and is, you know, regrown. And it's like nature can get, you know, you can have a cyclone come through and destroy some corals and then it reseeds. It's not like that's the only location. It's all around that area. But you know, that specific strain technically is off the market too, as long as, you know, that was the UC Purple Monster is what we were calling it at that point, because it landed at UC. What we're collecting now, again, from the same island, from the same reef, from that same area, but it's not 2015 strain, right? It's different.
It adapts.
But I think the logistics of trying to be like, oh, well, this is the 2024, you know, unless we're barcoding corals, which I'm just not there yet, and don't plan on being. Like, you do see that from Indonesia, where each coral, the mariculture corals, come in with a little bar tag, a little barcode. I mean, I think that's rad. A lot of information can be gained from that, but that requires everyone agreeing to the same code and playing by the same rules. And unfortunately, it's sort of Wild West. Once it hits the United States market, people are going to call it, you know, whatever creative Instagram name they can.
I mean, unless you're doing genetic testing, right, in terms of the original OG purple monster that was collected back in 95 or whatever it was, versus what you're collecting now.
There's people out there that can do that. Yeah, there's people out there that can do that. If anyone in chat or whatever wants to line that up, I'm happy to send specimens. I don't have any OG on hand.
You might get some imposters out there that'd be like, yeah, send it to me. I'll take care of that. Just they want to get the...
Sure. There are accredited labs that do genetic studies. I mean, I remember someone was trying to get blue millipora to see if like Palmer's blue or whatever.
That's a kick-ass piece.
It's a great...
I've got that coral. Yeah. I love that coral.
Yeah. Yeah, but they wanted to genetic sequence that one. And I think at the time we had it. So I sent him some pieces. That was on Reef Central, I found that guy. So I could look him up again. But anyways, yeah, I mean, I'd be happy to send some pieces for genetic testing to see if these are in fact the same strain. It's, you know, for what it's worth. I don't know if that would change the market price on anything, but it's peace of mind.
Just a little sidebar about the blue millipora. Is that a rare, morph of the millie in terms of a blue millipora? Do you see a lot of blue millies?
If I would say 1 in 500
are blue.
Is blue. Wow. Pink with blue tips, pink, green, blue tips. There's sort of a four color, the pink fading into blue tips with green tentacle polyps and then a yellow axial. That's like my top of the line. That's like 1 in 1,000 or wow. So I'll see. We get a lot of pink out here. We get actually less green than pink. Pink's more common. But those like, you know, multicolor and especially blue, you see way less of it. It's just less common.
I love...
So when I see it, it's always noteworthy when
I see it. Yeah, your probably eyes like grabs your attention. I love sunset millies. I think those are so cool.
Oh, they're gorgeous. They're gorgeous. Yeah. Yeah, I think one of the first coral strains that like moved me where I was like, had a dream about that coral, you know, was a sunset monopora, you know, that tangerine orange with like lime green polyps, just stunning coral. Yeah. It's funny that that's not really considered a fancy coral anymore, but it's such a pretty coral.
Yeah. So, no, I mean, that's like a starter type of coral now for a lot of people. You know, you can get like a frag for 15, 20 bucks and grows like a freaking weed and it is gorgeous.
I think that's a great thing. I mean, I remember when that was $100 piece of coral and now it's, you know, oh, hey, you should have some of this. And it's common. And that's a testament to the captive farming, you know, aquaculture of how powerful that is and what a market force that is. I think that's a great thing. That's sort of anybody who's against collecting coral for genetics in, you know, wild coral. I think I would throw that at them of like, here's a coral that used to be rare and exotic and only a few pieces came in and it's become almost ubiquitous because of people in the hobby keeping it alive and trading it and, you know, giving it to friends or selling to friends cheaply. Like that's a cool thing.
Let's get into some questions and comments from the viewers. Yeah. Just again with the purple monster, I sent Meckley a piece a while ago and Chris says in the chat here, mine is doing very, very good. It is puddling way better than the first piece. I sent him two pieces and the first piece I sent him crapped out after a while. It can be a tricky, sensitive coral for sure.
But we had talked about, I believe last time, so to reiterate, where I'm seeing it is warm, shallow water, low flow, not high flow. So shallow protected lagoons, high light though. So not just because it's low wave doesn't mean low light. So it wants a lot of light, still almost stagnant hot water. That's where I'm seeing it. And that's where I see it. I mean, purple, like Barney the dinosaur purple in the wild. And that's where I've collected it from. And that's where we farm it because, you know, you want to keep corals in the conditions that they do best in. So I don't know if in captivity, if we're replicating that, you know, because we usually want to have high energy, high flow, thinking that, you know, what was Jake's flow in a can? More flow, the better. It can't have enough flow. That's not the case with Purple Monster. So it might just get agitated from high flow conditions or outcompeted by other corals in those conditions, because it's famously hard to keep alive. It's a famously difficult coral.
Well, the thing is that it is such a slow grower that so over time to be able to grow a big piece is challenging because there's a lot of things that can happen over time to any coral. There's a lot of failure points and you know, the other thing is the fact that it's such a slow grower, and if you have it in a captive reef, you know, display tank, the chances are it's going to get overgrown or shaded out by something else. You know, so it's very, right. very tough to right. place that coral in a reef tank and to kind of anticipate the other coral's growth around it. You really want to just give it a wide berth.
Yep. Yeah, I see it. I actually see it in the same areas. It'll be like a coral rubble area, shallow. I'm talking less than 6 feet deep, sometimes even four, like wading depth, right? So 4 feet of deep water. And it'll be in the same areas that I'm seeing like cingularia tufts. So it'll be like a rubbly reef flat, not a lot of coral. And then you'll have a bommy with like green leathers. Like I'll see in areas like that where, you know, other corals can't hang.
Right.
So it's not getting out competed by their acros because other acros don't like that area. It's too bright. It's too warm. You know, it can handle that super sort of blasted, you know, high heat, high light, not a lot of flow and oxygenation, and other corals just crap out. So it might just be that conditions aren't dialed up enough for it so that other corals can outcompete it.
Let me ask you,
but I've never seen it in cool water. Yeah.
Interesting. Let me ask you a related question to the purple monster, and then I'm going to stop obsessing over this coral, even though I love it. I think
we got to get you out here. So you can see
that would be pretty unbelievable. I think the last time I had you on, you mentioned, or maybe it was Jake that wrote in his article about the expedition, about also finding some blue monster coral. Is that something that you've seen lately? Some coral that is similar?
Yeah. So just a color variation of the same species. We did see, so Longocyathus, it's Acropora longocyathus is the strain, is the species. I've seen it in other areas and it looks completely different. I mean, the polyp structure is the same, but the coral structure is a lot more like echinata under different conditions. And so if I was to say, this is purple monster, it looks like a echinata on steroids. People would be like, you're just trying to use the monster name. Like it's the same species. It's just different wild conditions create a different, you know, different form. It's adapted to different, still low energy, cooler water, lower light. You know, maybe a little more flow, but different conditions. So that'd be a monster as well. But when we were out collecting, yeah, there was some gradations in that purple to blue. So that was where blue monster came up. Also, we saw more of a green undertone that I don't think OG was showing. The OG per monster, I mean, you've had it long enough. Under different conditions, does it green out a little bit on the growth edges?
I know
Meckley
has seen the green in the in some of the frags that I've sent him. And I think, yeah, if I look at, depending on... Mm-hmm. The piece that I have under my halides, I can kind of like see a faint green tint, but not under the LEDs.
Okay.
But yeah, so I think that's
right.
Something that's true.
Okay.
Did we talk about what species is the purple monster? Is it a little ripe piece?
I believe it's Longocyathus. When I was talking to Jake about it, he at first thought it was Cophodactyla, Acropora Cophodactyla. And then we looked more at Longocyathus. I believe it's Longocyathus. So that's where that's what I'm sticking with, Longocyathus. So, but it was a bit of a toss up between Acropora Cophodactyla and Acropora Longocyathus. So I'm the former. And I think I got Jake onto it as well. I think he agreed. But you know, when you get something in your head and it's hard to let go of it, even when you agree in a conversation, like, oh yeah, you're right. And then 5 years later, you're back to your old idea and you have to get sort of re-convinced.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Speaking of species, Big ES is asking, and this is a question that's come up before in this live stream. Are Spathiolotus considered now Millies now?
I don't think that they're the same. I have on the reef that I usually collect Millipora, I've collected one Spathiolata, one relatively large colony. The way you see it from Australia, where it's that really pastel sort of pink to green gradation, you know, a thicker branch structure than Acropora millipora, definitely thicker than Prostrata. So I do see a difference. And again, same, it's not like, the argument would be like Spathiolata is just millipora under different conditions.
Hmm.
So to counter that, I've seen Spathiolata on the exact same reef that I collect thousands now of milliporas. Under the exact same conditions, same flow, same depth, same everything, and it's different. So yeah, it's genetically a different coral. Again, it would take genetic testing to prove it, but under identical conditions, it looks different.
Yeah, Jason Langer says genetic testing is not cheap, but so much could be gleaned from it, for sure. Yeah, that would be cool, like to be able to have.
Yeah,
that.
it's just is the juice worth the squeeze?
Yeah.
Yeah, like that to know the difference, it's like, oh, okay, now we figured it out. Like, is that worth thousands of dollars of testing? Not for most people.
So getting back to the spathulata versus milli and prostrata and whatnot, I think the perception is that spathulata is a harder coral to keep if you're buying into the fact that a spathulata is different than a millipore.
Yeah. Yeah. I haven't. So I have never seen it where it's dominant on a reef. So I can't say like this is what the conditions it really likes are. I've been on reefs where millipore is dominant. I've been on reefs where echinata, even speciosa is dominant, right? In certain areas, in certain conditions. And Acropora likes to do that. Where Acropora can thrive, its whole niche is to outcompete and, you know, claim real estate faster than other corals can. I've only seen here in the Solomons one piece that I can verify is spathulata, and it was intermixed with milliporas. So I don't know exactly, you know, where, maybe if it's a little cooler or a little more south facing, and that's just going to take time to lay claim to. One thing that you brought up earlier that I didn't get a chance to riff on, and if yeah. I may, exploration here. So during the original incarnation of Solomon's exports, there was one American exporter and three or four locals. They only had one football field size island called Big Nuhu that they collected on, Little Nuhu and some submerged reefs. There was Tandai for deep water and the west end of Haniara for millipora. Across the bay in Florida, it was mostly villagers bringing coral. It wasn't a whole lot of going there to collect coral. That was the entire Solomon export market for 20 plus years, or nearly 20 years. I've inherited a lot of those same dive sites, but I'm trying to expand on it. I think if we were looking at it by map and sort of highlighting the amount of reef, probably 4 to 5% of the actual reefs of this country have been, you know, documented and seen. Meaning 95% of it is still unexplored, undeveloped, you know, those rocks haven't been turned over to see what bugs are on the other side, right? Like, so, you know, getting a boat and getting out there is really key to this working. Yeah, to this being what it could be. Indonesia, there's hundreds and hundreds of operators. In Australia, you've got, you know, $2 million boats that are out for, you know, 2 weeks at a time doing these expeditions and checking stuff out. I'm still using a little, you know, 40 horsepower outboard fiberglass boat and trying to get as far as I can afield. Like, we're not, to do an expedition is hard here, but to try to both balance a business and balance the exploration aspects and finding new stuff, it's hard to satisfy all those needs while keeping the business profitable. But, you know, there's so much undiscovered here. There's so much. I'm looking at some deep water reefs right now that, you know, I don't want to give away too much, but deep water is where I'm really seeing things that could be amazing. And those don't even show up on, you know, on surface maps. Those are underwater seamount type stuff that I want to be checking out. So that's where my attention's at right now.
Do you think new species?
You know, the pitch is 95% of this country. And I think verifiably.
Do you think you're going to potentially see new species of corals in terms of the deep water acros you're potentially going to be diving to?
Strains, if not species, strains. On the LPS front, last time I had a good conversation with a sit-down conversation. I've talked to him since then, but last time we had a really good, long sit-down conversation with Julian Sprung, because he spent weeks out here on Liveaboard Billy Kiki back when he made his first books. If you look at his first, you know, Corals of the Pacific books, or the two books, the Corals and the Invertebrates books that he put out, half of those photos are Solomon Islands, you know, photo credit Solomon Islands. Last time I sat down with him, he described three different soft coral species that he knows locations of and where to find here, that just he didn't have time to describe them. I mean, there's a lot of undocumented, undescribed species here.
That's so cool.
So, and stuff that I'm sure that, you know, I'm looking for bright sellable milliporas. I'm not looking at, you know, I'm not looking for jake corals. I'm looking for the oddballs, you know, because I have to keep the lights on. But as far as species, I'm sure I've swam over a bunch of them that were, you know, still just didn't catch my attention because I wasn't looking for them.
Yeah. All right, some more questions here from the viewer. Sturgis Reef. Speaking of deep water, how are you collecting at 90 feet? Are you using mixed gas to stay down long, or are you just doing short dives?
No, it tanks. It tanks. We do short dives. I'm probably down for 15, 20 minutes, and then a good surface interval, placing corals, surface time, and then back down, collect more. You know, staging them under the boat and then bringing them up once the dive's over after decompression. Yeah, so back when I was in the Marshall Islands, I did about 6 months in the Marshall Islands in 2010, and we were collecting fish at 150 to 200 feet, and that was like still single tank, dumb, risky collection, but that involved a lot more decompressing the fish and doing things in stages. 90 feet is not quite so bad, and we can still do it on regular bottles, but I don't go any deeper than that. It's just not worth the risk at that point. We're looking to step up our deep water side of things, and to sort of increase our tech level, but that's an investment. So
we might have talked about this the first time I had you on, but just refresh our memories in terms of when you're on a mission in terms of diving, collecting corals, and what have you, and you've got your 40 horsepower, powering your skiff. What's the process in terms of, are you basically bringing up corals and they're sitting on the deck of that skiff out of water until they get back to your holding facility? Yeah. Is that what's going on there? I mean, so they're really getting exposed to a lot of elements.
And we've sort of learned what the coral's limits are as far as time out of water. And deep water coral does not like being out of water. I mean, it's not about being a prima donna. It's just nothing in their life genetic experience has ever meant they had to deal with low tide, right? They're always, if you're a coral that lives its life 45 to 80 feet, you never experience low tide. So you're just not equipped for toxins building up and not getting flushed away. You're not built up for warm water, warm temperature, any of that. So when we're collecting near the station, we'll collect, put it on the boat, and we have a staff member on the boat rinsing it. I don't yet have live wells and sprayers and things to keep the water with fresh seawater and cool. That's in the works. But right now it's just a guy with a bucket, which is, pouring cool water. We wrap it up with newspaper. When me and Jake went, we actually didn't prepare for how much coral we were going to be taking back. So we used seagrass. We actually went and cut turtle grass, like 2 centimeter wide turtle grass, cut a bunch of that and use that to wrap up corals. But yeah, the biggest thing is keep it wet, keep it cool, keep it out of the sun. If we're going out for days at a time, like on this trip we're going out for, we'll stage it in the shallows. A couple days of collecting, staging it. We'll put buoys out so we know where we've been staging it, so we don't spend, half a morning looking for coral that we've bank vaulted. Yeah. And then go back, pack up the boat first thing in the morning while the sun's not quite, up in the air, and then make a beeline for the station. We aim for an hour and a half or less time out of water. That's maximum.
Wow. I mean,
So I've had some of the Australian experts told me. Yeah.
Temperature acclimation, when you bring those corals back to the facility, I've heard Chris Meckley, talk about that, I've heard Jake talk about it, that you do not have to temperature acclimate acros. Has that been your experience?
No.
Different.
So our water temperature is pretty consistently 79 to 81 degrees. It's warm. My tanks were able to, we've got enough, we sort of staged with enough sunlight. We've got it where they're right at 81 degrees full time. And every time we've logged our temperatures, 81 degrees. So our corals are used to that. Deep water corals are cooler, right? They're used to cooler water, but our surface collected corals and the tanks, we keep at 81 degrees. So where, again, deep water, we try to keep them usually out of the sunlight. We're keeping them in sunlight for long-term for just sugar availability, but for cooler water, we'll keep them in the middle of the warehouse. It's a little bit cooler, like a degree cooler.
I guess what I'm asking you, man, is when you bring them back to the holding facility after collecting, dive or what have you, are you sitting there and kind of acclimating them to the temperature of the holding facility? If you've got some, no. Okay.
No, get them in the water as fast. Get them out of wrapping and into the water as fast as possible. We've never had.
Okay.
Yeah, we've never had a problem from that. It's the only time we've had a mass die-off after collection is when they were on the boat for too long. Even with pouring water over them, even with, being as delicate as we could, it was just too long of a dive trip. We were out on the water for too long, and the deep water corals didn't like the exposure. Yeah. The shallow corals didn't care, but the deep water corals protested, and we lost a lot.
That makes sense.
So lesson learned, never having that happen.
Yeah, yeah. Alex Correa is making a comment here. This is related to the tour you gave a while ago, Tim. Real colors, real pigments is right there. Remember what Chris said, Meckley. Halides to grow, LEDs to show. Laugh out loud. Sun is indeed the ultimate lens for pigment fermentation. Yeah, for sure. LEDs to show.
Let me, I'm going to run and grab a thing. I can be off camera for 5 seconds, but I've got a thing to show you. So for a brief period of time, I took a year away from the aquarium business to work underwater cameras. It was actually Pace HD, a 3D camera company, but I did the underwater side of it. Same company that did Avatar. But I got this guy. It's a diveable underwater color chart.
Oh, really?
And I'll take it to show like I'm not full of shit. Like if I take a photo of a coral, this is, you know, you can calibrate off of that. Yeah. Because there's so much dishonesty in coral photography and coral,
that's awesome,
online
man.
Coral
I love that.
Sales.
That's a great.
I wish more. I mean, it was a $60 piece of plastic at a photography supply place, but you know, it's diveable. Like it's made, it's printed on plastic. I can actually, you know, use it as like a writing tablet underwater, but it cuts all the bullshit. Sorry. Cuts all the BS out of the coral sales game. Like, take a photo. You know, they always say like take a photo under white light. Take a photo under
moonlight.
I love that,
dude. That is right? That should be standard practice for anybody. That
it should be standard.
That should be. That'll cut out a lot of the bullshit, for sure, in terms of what's been going on.
Yep. Well, that's DGK Custom Balance, DGKColor.tools. If you want to, you got a website thing you want to sell. There's a thing to sell,
nice.
Right?
So. John Wright. His question is related to actually shipping, exporting, you know, the corals to folks, to wholesalers. As Tim learned a lot about transporting corals, I recently saw Chris Meckley with great advice on transporting different corals. What have you learned there, Tim, in terms of, you know, over time exporting corals, shipping, in terms of the transshipping?
I've learned a lot, and it's actually really good to have Chris Meckley in the in that question line, because I've wanted to ship to him. I haven't yet shipped to Chris, and I've wanted to. He set a pretty high bar for me to be able to have corals be viable for 48 hours in a box, and I wasn't able to reach that to where I felt comfortable sending him corals. And so I haven't followed up on it because it's too warm here, and I haven't been able to simulate the temperature of an airplane cargo hold, which could be in the 50s
Do you use like a heat pack or something?
So I've learned, I don't have access to heat packs here. I could import them, but it's its own sort of thing. I don't have cool. I don't have a refrigerated room. I can't get an air conditioned room cold enough to show it. I've had corals viable for like 36 hours, but 48 hours at where I feel comfortable saying I can get you 100%, except to LA, I have, you know, less than 1% DOAs pretty darn consistently, but you know, to Texas, to the middle of the country, or as far as the East Coast, I can't say that with enough confidence, which I hate. I've made changes. There's, you know, new styrofoam and bigger plastic bags and higher quality oxygen. There's things I've learned, you know, to make that packing process better. We pack, either you could say smaller corals to bigger bags, which from a business perspective is less profitable, but it increases our live arrival percentage. Biggest thing I've seen that I've had to change is taller styrofoam. The styrofoam I was able to get in country, and again, I'm on the edge of the third world, so supply chains of styrofoam are rough.
Yeah.
But bringing in taller styrofoam, which means that there's more oxygen in that bag, increases my shipping distance. So I hope he's still in channel. He can hear that, because he put a good challenge. You know, like when you put a high bar, someone has to rise to the occasion or fail too. He set a really good high bar for me to learn to ship better. So working on it, working on it.
Well, you know, I'm sure Chris would be motivated to get some of the purple monster there. So, you know, Aqua Splendor, Reef Bum. How many species of Psyllopora I can't pronounce the scientific name. I'm just call it Bacillopora family. Does he think he has their Stellophora?
Bacillopora,
yeah. Yeah, that's Stellophora, Bacillopora, Seripora, Madracis. Madracis.
Madracis. Yep. Madracis. Yep.
Talk to us about.
It might be Madracis. Yeah. So that was Reese Splendor asking. Fantastic question.
Aquasplendor. Yeah.
Aquasplendor. The honest answer I can give you is that a gorgeous pink Stellophora that catches my eye, like, man, that's pink, right? And I'm like, oh yeah, no one buys that. That's what my customer's gonna say. If I send it to my customer, they're gonna be like, why the hell did you send me this? I don't want it, right? Like, I get scolded if I collect it and send it. And so I take a look at it and then I move on. And unfortunately, the market doesn't want it. And it's a rad coral, right? If I knew that it would sell and it wasn't destined to sit in someone's, you know, can't sell pile and eventually turn brown and die, because I've seen that, I would collect more of it. We would farm more of it. But it's one of those things that, despite having a beautiful color, Pacillopora just gets left behind. Other than the Stellophora that's Milcostylo. Other than Milcostylo, again, I don't know if anybody, in Milcostylo is now considered a cheapy frag. Like, yeah. It's a gorgeous purple coral.
It is an awesome coral.
People aren't really that into it. Yeah, yeah. I did just collect a really cool Stylocosaniella that was like red, like blood red the other day. So that's going to get sent, and it's on our CITES. That falls under that, like, you know, Jake corals of corals that like collectors are into and people that are into really niche market stuff. And it's a failing on my part that I can't tell you how many species we have here. I'm sure the species, it's dense, but it's just, I only have so many hours underwater to pay the bills. And so when I'm underwater, I'm focused on what I know is going to sell, because the customers are already asking for it. So, you know, now that you've given me a good stumped me question, I'm going to pay a lot more attention to it. So,
Aquasplendor says, dude, give me the pink stylo and the posy. I've been trying for 2 years. But he's in Canada, or she's in Canada.
Get your so if you can do me a solid and let me know like who you're buying from and who your supply network is, and then I can get, you know what I mean? Like, then that basically then demand forces the retailer to request it, and then the wholesaler I ship to will stock it. It's just one of those things that, like, if I send it to a wholesaler, they're not going to know that there's demand on the retail end, because no one's asking them. It has to go up the chain for me to send it. I think it's gorgeous coral, but, you know, if the wholesaler doesn't want it, they're not going to want to pay for it, and they're not going to pay the airfare for it when I send it.
It's a crime, because years ago I had this kick-ass pink stylo that was just this neon pink. It was vivid, and maybe that's what you're talking about, that you can collect there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is just a freaking, like that. Pink. Yeah, like that. I think that is just the best kind of, I mean, you know, I love bright colors. I love solid bright colors. Mm-hmm. And that sort of color was just, you know, and you can't, I mean, that's probably why Aquasplendor is like, please send me that pink stylo, because you don't see it anymore. And and it's weird, because, you know, you don't see a lot of hobbyists that have it in their tanks right now.
I got really excited, and I just don't have the bandwidth to be watching much of YouTube, but I got really excited when I saw the 52 weeks of reefing, the most recent stuff that they're putting, or at least this season, because they were going to do a shallow water, one species of cardinal fish, Bommy, right? And he'd even posted that he wanted to do like multiple frags of the same coral so they grow in together, because that's what I see on the reef, right? Like, you go on a reef and there'll be a massive, you know, piece of furniture or couch or even car-sized head of Pacillopora cylindrica, finger parades, the yellow finger parades, right? In shallow water, that dominates, right? And it's yellow. It's actually less green than this yellow. It's like canary yellow, right? And then you have, what do they call them? Threadfin cardinalfish. The cardinalfish is silver, but at the right light, it's lightning blue.
So cool.
That swims in and out of it. And it's, you know, uses it almost like an anemone fish. And it's gorgeous, but that's another coral that if I send it, the suppliers are like, why did you send me this coral? It's junk. But it's canary yellow. I mean, there's no Acropora that's that yellow, you know? And that next to a yellow coral like that, next to a pink coral, like some Ceratopora or a cat's paw or Pacillopora, the yellow and the pink set each other off so well. And it's something that I see in the wild, but It's just there's no interest in that.
Then you throw a little Tortuosa, blue Tortuosa in the mix there, and that is a kick-ass tank.
Right. That we collected at, I would see those relatively close together. That was a little deeper, you know, not in like splash zone, but that was like, you know, snorkeling depth. You'll see Tortuosa. Yeah. Like the immortal tort that that I collected with Jagan 15, that was snorkeling depth, maybe 20 feet. Yeah, shallow.
Wow. Todd at Champion Lighting Supply says, and this is so true, the pinks get washed out in the Windex tanks. That's what's going on. A lot of people have the blue, you know, lit tanks, and that stuff is not really popping. So, you know, you're not seeing a lot of full spectrum type of lighting in tanks these days. And yeah, that's what's happening.
I think that there's just been a lot of, it's going to sound really crotchety of me, but like short-term gain, a lot of like, what's the trend on Instagram, and we'll target our sales to that. Not long-term. What's a good looking coral from 10, 15, 20 feet away. I like, you know, the old guard was into white light tanks.
Yeah.
You know, my friend in Los Angeles, Dave Botwin, white light tanks, you know, tanks that look good from 20 feet away. Tanks that like when someone walks into your house, they're like, oh, wow, that looks cool. Not a coral that you have to like get
orange lens,
an oil stain from someone's forehead on your glass so they can see the differentiations in coral polyps. Like rainbow tenuous does not look that good from 10 feet away. It's kind of a bland, boring color, but under a macro with tons of blue light, it blows your mind. So it's, you know, what's driving demand. And right now, or at least for the last 5 years, it's been frags of corals that look really good under blue light and Windex tanks. And maybe that'll shift, maybe that'll change. But, you know, now that you're seeing Fiji open up, that might change. Cause that was, you know, kind of a big vendor of, you know, pink Stylophora and yellow leathers and stuff. So maybe that will change the trend a little bit.
What are some other corals that you think don't get the respect that they deserve, that you're, you know, that you see and you just can't collect because you just feel like they're not going to sell?
One of my favorite corals that has never been popular is Gold Galaxia. Comes out of Indonesia. I don't collect it here, so you're, you know, throwing attention towards a rival exporter, right? But it's a gorgeous coral. Under a macro, it looks a lot like Gold Torch, right? Like what's that? Holy Grail Gold Torch, right? It's greens and oranges. Yep. It's aggressive. It needs an area, but like under in reefs with chalice corals and other sort of like low light or lower energy, more higher nutrient corals, it's a gorgeous coral. And they're strong as hell. They're tough to kill. It's just a cool coral. They're fraggable. It's something you can share with friends. It does need, you know, it needs a perimeter. But there's a lot of collectoritis. A lot of people want like one of every coral, and they don't think of like what the environment that these corals come from and what do they complement each other best with. And so I think that's one of those corals that sort of forces a perimeter around it. So like you put that coral in, it's going to define an area of your tank that nothing else is going to take your attention away from. And it's just a cool coral. So that's a coral I wish got more love. It's not expensive. It's a cool one. I brought up earlier Sunset Monopora. That was the first coral that made me like, oh man, like what would it be like if there's fields of this coral, you know, well before I'd ever gone diving, I imagined that like these super rare corals were common in the wild and they're not, you know, you go over a reef and there'll be hundreds of like a common strain and then one of something unusual that gets a name in the States.
Staghorns to me too are like gorgeous corals. You know, you don't see too many tanks these days with staghorns. Is that kind of your observation too in terms of?
I got scolded last time I sent 10 pieces, not big, you know, medium large pieces of blue staghorn. I got scolded. Why'd you send me that? No one wants that. Like it's because it's blue staghorn. It's gorgeous.
That's messed up. Messed up. I don't get it.
I don't either. If I like a coral, I mean, I've been a hobbyist. I've been a, you know, aquarist to the stars. I've been an importer. I've sort of worn every hat in this industry, and I think I know what good coral is. And unfortunately, I made the wrong call on blue staghorn.
I mean, you know, I think here's what I like, and this is just me. But, you know, maybe other people, you know, have similar thoughts. But I think there's nothing better than a mature reef tank. Staghorns, tabling acros, and cupping Montipora.
Oh, yeah.
That you know, how can you beat that combination, you know, in terms of just.
So staghorns all see on a back reef a little bit lower energy, and they will completely take over and make a thicket where that's the only coral there. So in the 2015 expedition with Jake, where we collected the tortuosa on a slope on the flat of that reef, the low energy back end, where basically the staghorn had taken all the wave energy away, whatever residual wave energy was left on that reef. So the medium energy was where the staghorn was. The low energy shallows, like snorkeling depth, was where we saw purple monster. So it went purple monster, a little bit deeper water, a little more energy. It was staghorn. It was mostly, God, what was it? I want to say it was green, but then we saw a couple pieces of like a turquoise blue. We collected those. Unfortunately, they bleached out. And when they got to the States, even though they weren't dead, they bleached out white, and the receiving guys that weren't very well trained threw them out thinking they were dead. And so that didn't become a thing, but that's still a gorgeous coral. And then as we got more towards high energy, we saw more Possilophora, and we saw Australogyra, which is another coral that no one cares about. It's a branching fobid. So it's a medium branchy coral, but it's a fobia. It's, you know, think like you get weird, like branching, Echinopora, sometimes Echinopora herida. Uh-huh. You get these sort of weird growth forms of corals that don't normally take that form, but it's a branching, fobid. And so that was on that reef, and that only comes from the Solomons. So that was on that same reef out in central. But yeah, that staghorn, for whatever reason, the buying public isn't there. And when I think of a mature tank, I think of the back of a tank with, you know, giant thickets of stag. A staghorn coral that I love. I actually used to get made fun of when I was at a wholesale company, because every time it came in, I was like, ooh, Robusta. I get made fun of because it's awesome. It's this, like, you know, it'll be like forearm thick branches, yeah, or even, you know, thigh thick branches of like gorgeous green, like watermelon green into pink red. And it's one that doesn't really sell that well. I've seen it under really high energy reefs where it almost tables out. It forms where the branches, yeah, go wide, yeah, and then fuse together, and it had a little bit of verticality to it. So it was a semi-tabling. Oh, here's what I got. So the tabling, you said that your ideal reef is staghorn, tabling, and millipora. Tabling and millipora on
cupping
the same
montipora.
Reef.
Cupping montipora. I love millies too.
Oh, cupping montipora.
Yeah, it's just like a cupping montipora. You know, they can get so big. And I had a cupping montipora that my clownfish hosted.
Okay, so where it forms a tower and sort of,
yeah,
like
a scrolling, scrolling cupping type of thing. I think that's kind of a cool look. Yep. You know. That's just, yep, me.
Okay, so like Montipora, the common one.
Yeah.
Yep, Capricornus. Yep. Yep. That is a gorgeous coral. So I have a soft spot for Capricornus. The Worldwide Corals has their grafted strain. At the same time that they were developing their grafted strain, I was working for a company in Malibu, Dock Aquarium. I almost wear their tank top, but I didn't want to show off my farmer's tan today. That was Kevin Phoenix had a service company called Dock Aquarium out of Malibu. So we had all, you know, celebrity customers, and he had a greenhouse. And in the summer we would grow coral gangbusters. In the winter we'd have to supplement the lights, but in the summer we could grow coral in a greenhouse. He really was his grow coral in Malibu under a greenhouse. And one of the customers had a red montipora with a little green freckle. And I'm a freckled guy, so I have an affinity for freckles on corals. And it was a little green, green fluorescent protein infection. And so I excised that piece, took it back to the greenhouse, and then grew it so that the growth edge was on that green freckle. That green freckle turned into a green line. We excised that piece out, and eventually it started to splay out and formed like a radiating graft, just like what Worldwide Corals had. And we were so proud of that coral. That was one where we, you know, frags were 150, yeah, and it was a big deal, or $200. It was a big deal. This is, you know, 2010, 2011. And when I think Worldwide released the grafted Starburst Montipora, I gave up because it was like, now they have a four color grafted Montipora. I'm like,
they got you beat.
I can't beat that. Yeah, I can't beat that. But I was really proud of like developing a strain of grafted coral from a single freckle. So yeah. Yeah, Dock Aquarium out of Malibu. He still services.
Oh, really?
So he's still doing, wow, it.
Mm-hmm. Well, listen, dude, I appreciate you taking all this time to chat with us again. And I know you're a very busy guy. Probably got a lot of things to plan out in terms of
we got some diving to get to.
Dive trips. Well, any Any final thoughts, man, in terms of what we've been talking about tonight? Anything else we missed, perhaps?
What I need to do is take more photos. I had intended to get you more media, and it just, there wasn't the time, there wasn't the camera to do it. I think I need to make it a point to get like a GoPro out here so we can dive and show some cool stuff and show. I think there's a big disconnect between reefers and divers, right? And if we can bridge that gap, I mean, I'm here, and when I'm diving, I might as well strap something to my head and, you know, sort of document what it is. And even if I'm not, you know, taking footage to show, at least we're just taking bulk footage and stuff comes out of that. Because like what reefers are guessing at what a reef should look like. Aquarists are guessing at what a reef should look like. When like coral bommies have combinations of species that we're just not seeing in tanks. And I think maybe if we can get some media out, I would do that. So I will make it a point to bring a GoPro in here.
Nice.
So I'll have media looking for you next time.
Looking forward to that.
Yeah.
Just a couple final comments from the viewers. Todd at Champion Lighting Supplies. Send me all your misfit corals. Blue Reef, you can see Tim has so much passion for coral and diving. Jason Langer, I love Monty's. Yeah. Paul, Great Bird of Reef, tell Tim I'll come work for free. So Tim, man, if wholesalers are interested in getting some of your corals, how do they get in touch with you? What's the best process?
Email is sales@pmcorals.com. I think I'm out there. I mean, I think we've sent our price list to everybody. So yeah, I mean, we should be on everyone's radar. But if we're not, sales@pmcorals.com, and we'll go from there. If it's retail, we'll direct you to if you're a retail customer, we got to respect the food chain. But we'll get you to a wholesaler, and we'll line up boxes that way. But yeah, I mean, we're eager to get stuff moved. So, also we're eager to expand our radius. I really was only working with West Coast United States, but we're ready to start doing, further afield. It's the key to get back to that Meckley conversation was styrofoam, taller boxes, more oxygen. So we're ready to expand our radius.
Paul, Great Bird Reef, just dropped your Instagram. You got an Instagram account, so we dropped
thank
the link
you
in the chat for
yeah,
that.
Yeah, thank you.
Eric Rude, Tim, you. I would donate your GoPro if you are serious. Eric Rude.
I'm 100%. to be honest, yeah. I'll take it. We'll use it.
All right, man. Well, listen, Tim, thanks again for taking the time, and really appreciate it. And I know everybody out there tuning in appreciate it as well. So I also want to thank my sponsors one more time, Polar Reef. Make sure to check out Polar Reef's new YouTube video that drops this Friday. The Polar Reef team gives us a behind-the-scenes tour of Fitz Fish Ponds in New Jersey, where some of the most spectacular Japanese coral are imported. The journey includes the arrival of some of Polar Reef's prize fish, including Jennifer Aniston, who won Grand Champion in Polar Reef's video last week. Make sure to subscribe to their YouTube channel at Polar Reef for video drop notifications. Champion Lighting and Supply. Thanks, Todd. Besides being a place for hobbyists to purchase saltwater aquarium supplies online, Champion Lighting is also a wholesale distributor for many popular brands. If you own an aquarium store or an aquarium service company, contact Champion Lighting through their website at championlighting.com to set up a wholesale account. And finally, GHL. As I mentioned, I'm all in and using the GHL products. Had a lot of success using their dosers, the Provolux controllers, the Mitra's lights, the cage director, etc. They produce high-quality German-engineered products. Also, a big thank you to Paul, who is the moderator as well as the president of the Boston Reefer Society. Please join and support your local reefing clubs. They are so important to this hobby. Also, want to let you know that all episodes of Rapid Reef Bum are available as podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and Amazon. My next Rapid Reef Bum live stream will be next Tuesday, April 9th at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. My guest will be return visit from Adam Derrickson from Battle Corals. You can check out the full upcoming schedule of guests on reefbum.com under the YouTube section. Until next time, be safe and be well. Later.